First of all, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to participate in the symposium this morning. And today I want to talk to you about some of the work that we've been doing looking at carbon cycling in the terrestrial environment, particularly the role that mineral complexation with carbon plays, and also the important aspect of metal redox cycling on carbon. I want to particularly acknowledge the work that I'll report on this morning from one of my former PhD students who's now a postdoc in my group, Chunmei Chen. I'll start out, most of you are familiar with this cartoon that shows the critical zone, which is a term that came out of a National Academy of Sciences report a number of years ago. It's a very elegant term in that it attempts to describe these coupled physical, biological, and chemical processes. And the critical zone is that area of planet Earth on which we live, which extends from the tops of the trees down through the soils, down into the water table. And you can see that soils comprise the complete portion of the critical zone, and then the critical zone contains portions of the atmosphere, the biosphere, the hydrosphere, and the lithosphere. And one of the, I think, very strong points about this concept is that we're trying to look at these couple processes over a range of spatial and temporal scales. So one can look all the way from the very large basin landscape scale all the way down to the molecular and the atomistic scale. And moreover, the temporal scales are very important because in the critical zone, time scales range all the way from seconds to eons. We've heard already this morning this great concern about CO2 concentrations that are increasing in the atmosphere, and we've now reached a level of 400 parts per million. And one often sees this fairly strong correlation between CO2 concentration and temperature. You can see temperatures here in the Antarctic, which pattern very nicely what one sees in the CO2 concentrations. So as Dr. Torn mentioned a few minutes ago, the understanding of organic matter chemistry, and particularly organic matter mineral interactions, which is a major way that we can stabilize carbon, the thinking about this has evolved considerably over the last few decades. And so the days when one thought that molecular structure determined the time scale of persistence, we now know that this cycling and this complexation depends on a number of factors. You can see on the right side of this figure that include things like physical disconnection, certainly as I'll talk about later, sorption and desorption with complexation, but also a lot of physical effects. And of course, a lot of importance to deep soil carbon and what will be occurring as environmental conditions change in these particular systems. So this morning I want to particularly focus on this work that we've been doing associated with a critical zone observatory that we've established funded by the National Science Foundation, where we've been looking particularly at organo-mineral interactions, which as we all know is one of the major mechanisms for carbon stabilization. But this complexation is controlled by a number of factors. The chemistry of organic matter, of course, is critical. One also needs to understand the mineralogy, things dealing with these iron, manganese, and aluminum oxides and phyllosilicates. And so, as all of you know, we've been studying organic matter for decades, and frankly, we still don't understand a lot about it because it's so complex and so heterogeneous. And various functional groups have been identified. And so what we've been particularly interested in our study is to try to understand at a more basic, fundamental, molecular level, what are the carbon functional groups that are involved, particularly with carbon-mineral interactions, and secondly, how are these functional groups spatially distributed on mineral surfaces. This diagram shows you that there are a plethora of environmental interfaces, redox interfaces in the soil environment, which greatly impact the biogeochemical cycling of not only metals, but also things like nutrients such as carbon. And the metal oxides, particularly iron and aluminum oxides, are quite important in retaining carbon because they often have high surface areas. However, under certain conditions, particularly reduced conditions, we can have reductive dissolution of these oxides, things like iron oxides and manganese oxides, which could enhance the cycling and the release of carbon. So I'm going to talk this morning particularly about this redox chemistry impacts related to iron and carbon complexation. And what one sees here is that the redox behavior greatly affects the solubility of the iron oxides, because under oxy conditions we have more of the ferric iron oxides, such as ferrohydrite and goethite. And then through microbial or chemical reduction, these can be destabilized to form iron II minerals, which can be released, and then one can cycle back to an oxic environment and the oxides can be reoxidized to ferric forms. We've heard a lot this morning about the role that soils play in carbon. This is some data that shows you that the various soil orders, and one sees that many of them, particularly things like histosols and septosols, can retain large quantities of carbon. However, in consistent with the theme of this symposium, it's fair to say that we don't understand a lot about what the impact of climate change will be on soils. And part of this is because we're dealing with the most complex biomaterial on planet Earth, soil, which has tremendous heterogeneity, both chemically, physically, and biologically. So that causes a lot of complexity. We know that we know a number of things about factors that might affect climate change. We're dealing with increased CO2 levels. Temperatures are expected to increase 2 to 4 degrees or higher. We have to deal with increased extreme events, which could have impacts in terms of wetting and drying cycles, storms, heat waves, fires. This is taken from a very nice article that Nick has written that will be published in Advances in Agronomy. And warming will cause reduction in soil carbon. These are data that show by 2050 the magnitude of release of carbon. You can see it's fairly significant. By 2100, due to warming, thawing, and greater microbial decomposition, then we could release large amounts of carbon. So this is particularly important in some of the polar regions. So the question is, what will be the magnitude of carbon release from these particular soils as we have melting? And so this is, I think, a very important thing that we need to understand, that soils, in this case, may not only be sequesters, but in many cases they could be emitters of significant amounts of carbon. So I'm going to talk now about some of the research that we've been conducting at the Critical Zone Observatory that we have. I'll first talk about one site that is a pasture site where we see this hill slope area. You can see that typically one would think at the upland areas that we would have well-drained oxy conditions. As one moves down the hill slope into the foot slope and wetlands, we become more poorly drained. And there could be two scenarios that could occur. One, under these poorly drained conditions, one might predict that we have slow carbon decomposition, where lignin would be preserved. On the other hand, under these conditions, we know that we could get reductive dissolution of iron and manganese oxides, and this could enhance dissolved organic carbon release. So we've been particularly interested in looking at carbon and iron speciation along different landscape topographic gradients under different land use, and particularly the role that these iron oxides play in carbon mineral complexation. So what I want to hopefully achieve this morning are three objectives. One, to investigate soil organic matter molecular composition under varying landscape topographic positions. Secondly, to assess these interactions with soil minerals at the small scale. And thirdly, to characterize iron speciation along redox gradients. So we have a number of field sites at the Christina River Basin CZO. I'm going to report on the pasture site and also a floodplain site. And we're very interested in how land use is impacting this carbon mineral complexation. So I'll talk a lot about small-scale techniques that we've been using to characterize this complexation phenomena. We have collaborated with Peter Leinweber at the University of Rostock to use pyrolysis field ionization mass spectrometry. And here one can look at thermal stability of compounds by looking at the pyrolysis as a function of temperature. We've also employed a large number of synchrotron-based techniques. The carbon work has been conducted at the Canadian Light Source in Saskatoon, Canada. We've used bulk near-edge X-ray absorption fine structure spectroscopy, where one can characterize carbon and nitrogen functional groups with minimal extractions. And then at the spectral microscopy line, we have coupled a scanning transmission X-ray microscopy with NextSAF spectroscopy. And with this finer scale approach, one can map a distribution of carbon, carbon forms, and major elements. We can look at light elements like potassium, calcium, heavier elements, iron, aluminum, silicon, getting down to very small scale resolution of 40 nanometers, and then get some assessment of the mechanisms of carbon with specific minerals. To get insights into the iron chemistry and speciation, we've used extended X-ray absorption fine structure spectroscopy. This was done at the Stanford Synchrotron Radiation Light Source. Using linear combination fitting of known materials to our unknowns, we can get fairly detailed information on iron speciation. And then to get even finer speciation data, we've used Mossbauer spectroscopy, which is a very excellent technique, particularly for iron speciation, where we can tease apart the different iron oxides and also get insights into structural iron in phyllosilicates. So these are some of the data for the pasture soil. You can see the foot slope as compared to the summit. We tend to see decreasing carbon with increasing soil depth. Slightly more carbon in the summit soil as in the foot slope, but you can see fairly significant amounts of carbon even in this 15 to 25 centimeter depth. These are some of the bulk NextSAFS data for soil carbon, again looking at landscape position as, and also a function of depth. And in the foot slope soils, we see an enrichment in aromatic carbon, depletion in aliphatic carbon, and slightly less carboxyl carbon in the foot slope, which could be related to slightly less oxy conditions in this particular region. Using the pyrolysis FEMS data, again, one can get insights into stability of different carbon groups. So here we're looking at lignins and lipids as a function of depth, again, the foot slope and the summit. The subsoils tend to be more enriched in lipids, lignins rather, depleted in lipids. And you can see that the foot slope soil tends to be more enriched in lignins. Now, if we look at the volatilization temperature, which gives insights into the carbon stability, these are looking at carbohydrates and amides. What we see is that at the higher temperature, we see the subsoils volatilizing there, which indicates that there's greater carbon stability in the subsoils for these particular groups. However, if we look at the more recalcitrant groups like lignins and alkyl aromatics, again, these are volatilizing at fairly significant high temperatures, which again suggests they're quite stable. But in this particular case, we don't see any real difference between the different layers of the soil. Now I want to show you some of the fine-scale data. This is some of the Stixom carbon NextSAFS data in the pasture soil. And we can collect chemical imaging and NextSAFS data by basically imaging sequential scans across a range of photon energies at the edge of the particular element of interest. And then one can collect optical density values, which are an indication of the thickness of the particular species, and from that we can get some information on the actual amount of the particular species. And so You can see on the left here for the summit and the foot slope, we were looking at carbon distribution maps, and these were determined by looking at the optical density below the edge for carbon, subtracting that from the optical density above the carbon edge, and we can get the different carbon regions. And then through principal component analysis and cluster analysis on the right set of images, we can actually see the different regions of carbon. And then using NEXAPS, you can see on the right two columns, we can actually determine what this functional group distribution is. And so not surprising here, we see typical functional groups like aromatic carbon, aliphatic carbon, carboxyl, and polysaccharides. We can also do the same kind of analysis with other elements. This is looking at calcium. And there was really no inorganic carbon in the soil, so all the carbon is organic. But you can see that the calcium in both the foot slope and the summit appears to be perhaps electrostatically absorbed carbon onto functional groups. This is extra polymeric substances or through calcium phosphate. And then looking at the iron distribution, again, as a function of landscape position, we see that both in the summit and in the foot slope that we're primarily looking at ferric iron. There is a little bit of iron, too, in the foot slope soil, but not a significant amount. We coupled the NEXAPS Stixim data with the X-ray absorption fine structure spectroscopy. Here we're looking at linear combination fitting for the two topographic positions. One sees a lot of iron associated with phyllosilicates, particularly things like vermiculite and illite. The iron oxides comprise about 50% of the total iron, and most of it is in the ferric iron, including ferrohydrite and goethite. Now this gives you, an idea of the correlation of the different elements. So we see a lot of correlation of iron with aluminum, which is not surprising because iron oxides could be coating the phyllosilicates. We also know that we have structural iron in the clays. We often see, as I'll show you later, both in this soil as well as in the floodplain soil, very strong correlation with calcium. This has been observed many times before. It could be due to a couple things. It could be simply that the calcium is electrostatically binding to functional groups, or it could be that the calcium is serving as a bridge between the carbon and the organic matter, the clay system, to stabilize the carbon. And we see less correlation with silicon, which is not surprising because of the low reactivity of things like quartz. This shows you the actual numbers for the correlation. Again, very high correlation with calcium, also with iron, some with aluminum and silicon. I should point out that the data that I just previously reported were recently published in Environmental Science and Technology. The other system that I want to talk a little bit about now is the floodplain site, where we can now look at variations in redox environments. This shows you the typical profile that we're dealing with. We have a pre-colonial deposit, which you can see this buried wetland, this very reduced type soil, gray modeling in the soil. Above that particular deposit, there is a post-colonial deposit, which is quite oxidized. You can see the red color, fairly rich in iron oxides. And then below the pre-colonial, we have the gravel and bedrock. And so at the Critical Zone Observatory, we have installed a number of in-situ real-time sensors where one can monitor things like redox potential over time. And what one sees here is that in the post-colonial deposits, in the gravel, over a range of time, we see oxy conditions, whereas in the buried wetland, for the most part, over the time scale we've looked here, the EH values are negative, indicating quite reduced conditions. If we look at the iron chemistry as a function of mineral surface area in these different deposits, we see some interesting results, not unexpected. But in terms of the iron using dithionite citrate bicarbonate extraction, in the post-colonial deposits, you can see much higher levels of iron than what we see in the pre-colonial deposits. And then one sees a very close correlation between the iron and surface area. So, for example, in the pre-colonial deposits, we see that the surface area is much less, which greatly reflects the reductive dissolution of the iron oxides under these reduced conditions, which correlates to a more dissolution of iron. If we couple that then with the iron speciation from XAFs, we can look at these different deposits. You can see a lot of iron 3 ferric iron phyllosilicates, iron 2 phyllosilicates. But what's interesting, if we look at the ferric 3 or the iron 3 oxides, we don't observe from XAFs any iron 3 oxides in this pre-colonial wetland, which again indicates the reductive dissolution of these iron oxides. However, to get a more precise understanding of the iron chemistry, we use Mossbauer spectroscopy. And these are data, again, here we're looking at the post-colonial deposits, the more oxic deposits, and we see a lot of iron 3 oxides, both of large and smaller particle size, and one sees also a considerable amount of ferric iron associated with clay minerals and some iron 2 in clay minerals. This is quite contrasting to the buried wetland, which is anoxic, and what one sees here is that the iron 3 oxides have completely disappeared. We don't see the iron 3 oxides at all now. And not only do we see a diminution of the iron 3 oxides, but we see a reduction in structural iron in the phyllosilicates. So there's a reduction occurring both in the structure of the clays as well as the oxides. In the gravel samples, intermediate again, a combination of iron 3 oxides, iron structural in the clays. Again, we can do on this particular wetland soil, one can do the carbon mapping using Stixom carbon XAFs. And we see a lot of heterogeneity, which is not surprising, at these small scales in soils, that the organic composition is varying spatially at the submicron scale in the reduced soils that are free of iron oxides. And so again, one can look at the different carbon regions. The brighter areas indicate more carbon, and then we can try to speciate the different functional groups that are shown on the right. Again, much like the pasture soil, we see very strong correlation with calcium, and the calcium tends to be either associated in absorbed manner, but certainly we don't see any calcium carbonate forming associated with calcium. The iron speciation, again, is shown here for the two different regions, the wetland region, and we see that the wetland soil did contain some iron 2, but a lot of iron 3. The iron 2 here is not due to the oxides, but rather it's due to the iron 2 in the clay minerals themselves. And again, the correlations were done much like what we saw in the other soil. We see this repeating strong correlation with calcium, some correlation with iron, aluminum, and silicon. So we're now trying to better understand exactly what the mechanism for this calcium carbon complexation is. Is it some electrostatic attraction? Is it more of a cation bridge binding between the calcium and the carbon? So let me now conclude making a few points. First of all, that the recalcitrant aromatic carbon and the lignin is enriched in the subsoils and these poorly drained foot slope locations. We saw that organic compounds had a greater thermal stability in the subsoils and in the poorly drained foot slope. Again, very strong correlation with calcium, which suggests that it plays an important role in complexation. And one saw that the anoxic conditions led to a strong reduction in structural iron in the clays, in addition to the reductive dissolution of the ferric oxides, which can enhance carbon loss from soil. So the organizers ask me to talk a little bit about what I think are some of the future needs in understanding carbon chemistry, particularly in view of climatic changes that we're observing. And I took this very nice diagram from an article in Nature that I think points out what we've heard this morning, that with these extreme events, for example, with drought, with fire, with all sorts of changes that are taking place, the erosion, physical effects, chemical effects, biological effects, we could well see fairly dramatic differences in carbon cycling in the terrestrial environment. And so I want to end by what I think are some future research needs related to that. And again, I've taken liberty of using some of Nick's ideas from his Advances in Agronomy article. But we're definitely going to see vegetation shifts. There are going to be microbial alterations, physical effects, mineralogical effects, many chemical effects in terms of soil acidification, salinization. We don't really understand under these conditions how carbon-mineral complexation will be affected. Nutrient cycling and metal cycling can be very important because these metals are obviously going to be intimately associated with carbon and minerals in the soil. So with that, I would like to acknowledge our funding sources, particularly the National Science Foundation, which has funded our Critical Zone Observatory, the Delaware Environmental Institute, particularly my colleagues at the Canadian Light Source, where we did the carbon speciation. The iron speciation was done at the Stanford facility, and colleagues at the Environmental Molecular Sciences Laboratory at PNNL were very helpful in the Mossbauer spectroscopy. And lastly, I always have the great pleasure of going and giving talks. I didn't collect any of the data. I hope I understand the data and I can explain it. But I want to particularly acknowledge this marvelous group of students and postdocs, particularly Dr. Chin, whose work I reported on this morning. So thank you very much.